Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout, doing our favorite thing every week. Brandon, we're talking a little politics. We've got huge shakeups in the presidential race. Beto mania is going to sweep this country, or so he hopes.
Yeah, and Trump fights with a dead guy. So
yes.
There you go.
When is that any different than any other day, right?
Right.
Well, let's get right into it. First off, the big news, the veto. We've been talking about this for a long time. With the national emergency that the president declared, the House came up and passed it. Now the Senate did. The president vetoed it. What does this mean?
Right, with a big Twitter veto, right, with a slammer. So neither chamber can get the two-thirds to override. So basically, this veto is going to stand. I think that the president's on pretty shaky ground here right now. The legal status of this is that if the Congress basically objects and the president's grant of power is shaky, then it's unlikely to withstand constitutional scrutiny. Congress voted twice to not fund this, basically. And though they have been deferential to presidential emergencies, so the president is on some sort of shaky legal ground here. The president's emergency may stretch the boundary of the legal buoyancy. I mean, the claims he's made may not withstand a kind of scrutiny from the court. But Jay, I'm awful at predicting this stuff, like like March Madness, like my bracket is already destroyed, right? So I don't know what to say except that the court could eventually kick it back and say, like, we don't have a role here. This is not a constitutional question. It's a political question. What do you
think is
going to happen?
Yeah, I tend to think that they're probably going to say that the president is in violation of that act,
okay,
the National Emergency Act. It's allowing him to use it, in large part because of what you said. The specifics, when you look at the previous instances when it's been invoked, it's been absent express congressional action. This is kind of the first time where you've had congressional action that granted a certain amount of money, a specific amount of money for border protection, but not the amount that the president wants. And sort of this is arbitrary. As a practical matter, I think the president's on, as you said, very shaky legal grounds. I think the court will likely rule against him, but it won't matter because from the president's perspective, this is all sort of political theater anyway.
Yeah.
Speaking of political theater, I don't know if you know this, but the president is in an ongoing dispute, and it just looks terrible for him, with a dead man, as you said.
Awful.
He and Senator John McCain are basically in a Twitter beef. The ghost of McCain is haunting Donald Trump.
And still winning, right? I don't understand why this is happening. But for those of you who have not been paying attention, here's the background. President Trump basically is criticizing the late Senator John McCain because reports surfaced that one of his associates, McCain's associates, had shared the dossier of allegations about Donald Trump and the ties to Russia with the media. So basically, Trump opens up this wound again, despite the fact that Senator McCain has passed on. He also suggested that Senator McCain got the kind of funeral that he would have wanted, and he never got a thank you. Like, he should have just been, like, first in line to get a thank you for this. Johnny Isaacson, I think, said it best. He said, this is a Republican senator from Florida who said, this is just deplorable. I like Chuck Schumer's idea. That is, he's going to reintroduce legislation to rename the Russell Building, the Senate, where some of the senators have offices, after John McCain.
Yeah, I think the irony of this is that Donald Trump is doing more to elevate the stature of John McCain than I think John McCain did himself in during his time in Senate. He's really been deified more and more so. And it just looks like bad form. You're getting sort of Trump supporters of the president that are just in a really nasty, aggressive way, trolling Cindy McCain, Senator McCain's widow, his daughter, Meghan McCain.
Yeah.
It's just getting very, very ugly. And again, we've said this before, it is beneath the office of the presidency to continue to engage this way, but the president doesn't seem to care.
And it's a political unforced error, right? Why continue the beef when there's no political upside? This is just the kind of thing that the White House does not need to get involved in, and it's in the way of their policy agenda, such as it is, and the whole thing is a mess. So hopefully it'll go away. But as we've seen, that's unlikely.
Well, Brandon, another week, more news on the 2020.
Speaking of not going away.
Speaking of not going away, it just keeps growing and growing and growing. And we'll get to the big news with our friend Beto O'Rourke running. But before we get to that, we got lots to talk about on the 2020 roundup.
Yeah, Joe Biden has continued to tease a run. He almost announced. Trump tweeted that he almost did that and didn't go all the way. So he's a low IQ individual. There's been reports that have suggested that Joe Biden is not the middle-class Joe people think, since he's got a $3 million vacation home. And there are worries, and I think this is actually pretty well-founded, that Biden might not win the money primary. We'll talk about Beto here in a minute, but he and Bernie have a tremendous resource when it comes to renewing their donations from a lot of people. Joe Biden may not have that, having been sort of out of elected office for a while. So what's your sort of take on whether or not Joe Biden gets in and what that does to the race?
Yeah, on Joe Biden, first off, I mean, this is a new Democratic Party,
yeah,
and it's a new Democratic primary process. The era of sort of getting a bunch of money from PACs and corporate donors is effectively gone. And so you're looking at smaller donors, you know, large numbers of donors. And as you said, that really benefits people with strong organizational support. We already know that a lot of sort of the Obama infrastructure isn't gravitating towards Biden.
Yeah.
They seemingly are gravitating towards other candidates. So I don't know what that means. He's got a tremendous amount of name ID. But let's be clear, Joe Biden is, I mean, he's been around politics for a really long time. He's run for president twice before, and he has stunk up the joint both times he's run. He's not a very good candidate historically. He's now become this beloved figure, and I would be concerned for himself, for him, that he's kind of going to tarnish some of his reputation by running, because all of the issues that happened in his long career that have created problems for him are probably going to get dredged up.
That's a great point. Actually, this would be like, say, Dick Cheney running for president, right? I mean, Dick Cheney was chosen, just like Biden was, to be a kind of counterbalance to a president who didn't seem to have that much experience. That's not going to work, right? As you say, the party has changed. Here's another question. Is the Electoral College in our future? Because many of the candidates have suggested that they want to undo it, including Elizabeth Warren. So is this a practical policy? What is the political upside in saying you want to undo the Electoral College?
Well, I mean, look, we've had two times this century where the person who's gotten the most votes has not been elected president. And so I, on the Democratic side of the equation, I think there's definitely people on the activist side who think, hey, look, every vote should count.
They see W's. They're like, we can win.
Yes, we can win this, right? And so I think abolishing the Electoral College through the constitutional amendment process is almost an impossibility. But I do think what you're seeing in states like Colorado, where they're saying all electoral votes are going to be going to the person who wins a popular vote nationally. I think you're going to see other states do modifications of that. States like Nebraska and Maine, they do a proportional system. You might see something like that. I think this question of reforming the Electoral College isn't going to go away. It may pick up some steam. But look, we live in a republic with 50 states, and every state has a voice in this, and so it's going to be different everywhere.
This last thing you said, I think, is exactly the point. This is the design of the Electoral College, and I'm not going to back it with any of my own money, but it's certainly the case that this was designed to be a representative system and to give the states some say in the balance. It also creates an institutional structure that allows the presidency to be independent of the other branches. So that's why it's there. I don't know that it's a good idea, but a national kind of popular vote would essentially create all kinds of candidates running, right? You'd have the 15 people who are currently running or more all running independently, right? And that's going to split the vote. So the winner of the presidency would get like 30% of the vote. Like, I don't know that that's a good threshold, but this is an ongoing question. I'm just not sure it really excites voters in that way. So I don't know how far it's going to go. Hey, but speaking of exciting people, Jay, there's been a huge scandal in higher education that really rocked a lot of schools, including some celebrities this last week.
Yeah, I think for you and I who are in the higher education space, as
indeed,
they say, this
that's
comes as no surprise. We know for a very long time there's a lot of problems in higher education, but I don't think we ever thought or many people ever realized that you had these celebrities and high net worth people trying to literally buy their kids' ways into college. It's a national issue that's affected many of the biggest name brands in college today, Yale and USC and others.
Never heard of
those schools, right? Yeah, I know. But these stories are pretty salacious. People pretending to be on water polo teams,
yeah,
and you know, rowing crew. People with put pictures with their faces superimposed on calendars. People getting bribed,
right,
to be recruited.
The University of Texas men's tennis coach got fired because he took a bribe for saying he was recruiting somebody and they weren't. Here's what I think the punishment should be. I think that for every school that put somebody on their roster to say they were being recruited and took a bribe for it, they should actually make them play tennis or water polo or baseball or whatever it was. We'll see how the teams fare then. I don't think you'll ever see this happen again.
I mean, the interesting thing to me, though, is it's really, I think, rekindled this conversation about the admissions process nationally at universities, which is a big issue, access to college. Everything from like the legacy system to affirmative action to how, you know, individual states are going through this process right now. We've got this ongoing case with Harvard University and admittance for Asian Americans. We've got issues surrounding the University of Texas that we mentioned earlier. So we've got all sorts
and now,
of things.
Aunt Becky is involved.
And now Aunt Becky from Full House. That's right.
Shame.
Bribing her way into USC.
Right.
So lots of things going on here. And as bizarre as that story is, Brandon, I don't
there's
more, because it's not anywhere as bizarre as the fact that Devin Nunes, a sitting member of Congress, has decided that he's offended by Twitter trolls and he's going to sue Twitter for letting them attack him.
People have been very mean to him on Twitter, so he's decided to go ahead and sue Twitter as well as some parody accounts. One parody account is of his mother, who tweets about how disappointed she is in him.
I'm disappointed.
And also from there's a cow, apparently, that Devin Nunes' cow, who also tweets mean things about him. So, I don't know, Jay. I mean, unfairness is certainly in the eye of the attack. It seems to me, though, there's enough outrage around in Twitter that everyone's getting a little piece of it, but you're the resident lawyer. I mean, I watch every episode of LA Law as a kid, so I won't speculate beyond my britches here. But like, as a public figure, and because these are parody accounts, there's no real valid kind of cause of action here. But I will say this is some pretty first class trolling from these folks who are doing it.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can't combat trolling this way, and Devin Nunes knows better. And if you really want to know, the troller in chief right now is out there doing this to many, many a person. Just ask the ghost of John McCain,
right,
and we don't hear him complaining.
Great, great.
Well, Brandon, let's shift gears. Texas, we've got a lot going on here. Massive explosion in Deer Park, Texas, that happened right outside the city of Houston.
Literally,
putting up all sorts of toxins into the air. Children, school districts have to be closed for a moment. We've still got excessive levels of benzene in the air. It put up this giant plume of smoke that's going, stretching all the way from Houston to Austin at one point.
It shows up on radar, right? It's so thick, it's like literally like a storm front.
Yeah, it has created all sorts of havoc. I think it shows a larger issue about the fact that there's a lack of kind of general enforcement. You know, Texas, the Gulf Coast, has often been jokingly called the carcinogen coast.
Right.
Well, this is exactly what the issue is because of the lack of regulation at many of these plants. The firm ITC that runs this plant has been heavily criticized for the way they're handling it. Politically, the county judge, Lena Hidalgo, has been kind of heavily criticized for the way she's been reacting to it. A lot to unpack.
I think that's right. And you definitely sort of identified something which a lot of people have pointed to, and that is that the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality has been slow to respond to these kinds of releases, as well as general shutdowns or fires or leaks. The companies know that TCEQ will not hold them accountable, and agencies are essentially allowing these companies to self-regulate. That creates this Faustian bargain where we rely on these chemicals and these plants as sort of part of our living daily life. But we also, of course, have these kinds of explosions or fires or leaks that happen literally every, 6 weeks, 2 months. And so that's something which I think is troublesome. And as much as TCEQ has been under fire for this, part of the responsibility lays at the level of the legislature, who has not given them enough enforcement power or enough money to be able to pursue these. So I think some big questions have to be asked, and it's time for legislature to do that.
Yeah, we know for a fact that cancer rates in and around areas around these plants is much higher than it is, for example, in other parts of Texas and other parts of Houston even. And so, look, the blame is on TCEQ. The blame is on the attorney general, who's been silent about enforcement. The blame's on Harris County's attorney for not enforcing some of these some of the laws here. So I think this has got to be dealt with. It's a major issue, and it may become a major political issue.
Very much so.
Speaking of politics, Brandon, we've been teasing this for a while about John Cornyn's vulnerability. We got ourselves a U.S. Senate race
all
in Texas.
Right. Let's put the gloves on and come out fighting,
And with a very familiar and pretty important name in Texas politics.
A bearded name, which we had weeks ago made fun of. We'll see if he keeps the beard. We are not fans of it, but Joaquin Castro, a Democratic congressman from San Antonio, is all but certain to enter the U.S. Senate race. We teased this a couple of weeks ago. Jay, what's your take on kind of what this looks like at from the 10,000-foot view? Obviously, we're kind of a long way away from this, but how does this shake out in terms of where Texas is generally and then kind of what it looks like with respect to the rest of the likelihood of, say, turning Texas blue?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the most significant, I think, race Senate-wise this cycle, nationally potentially. You have the opportunity of doing two things. One, really, I think, energizing the Latino community in Texas in a way that they haven't before, against a vulnerable incumbent in a likely Democratic year. We already know, we talked about this before, about the numbers of gravitating in Texas to make it much closer to 50-50. Castro is a good candidate. In many ways, he's a more gifted candidate than his twin brother. Mm-hmm. He's been a leader on border issues. Remember, it was his bill that the president just vetoed. He's popular. He's got a lot of grassroots support in and around the area. I think the Democrats could not have hoped for a better candidate. It's interesting. He is far more progressive on issues than, say, Beto O'Rourke was. And O'Rourke was, I think, called very much sort of liberal and socialist by Ted Cruz. Castro is one of only two members of Congress from Texas to sign on to the Green New Deal. That will be in commercials here in Texas.
That will definitely be in commercials that he runs and also those that Cornyn runs, right? Yeah, I think you've made a good point. That is that, like, the Latino vote is going to be key to this. O'Rourke underperformed in terms of getting Latino vote out. Castro will do a much better job at making that happen just by virtue of the fact of who he is and where he comes from. He's going to do much better. But the problem is he's only got about 125K in the bank. He's going to really have to ramp that up. Cornyn's got about 5 million. Joaquin has never been a tremendous fundraiser, so he's going to really have to make the money work for him. I don't know if he has that same grassroots level support that O'Rourke had in terms of fundraising, so that's to be seen. And he's going to need the money because Cornyn's game plan is going to be to paint him as way too liberal for Texas, the same way that Cruz tried to do for O'Rourke. The fact that he's got this money in the bank allows him to be able to start that much more early. But I think ultimately this is a good thing for Texas Democrats. Castro was patient, maybe too cautious. This is the moment of payoff, if all that is to pay off. But I think the real issue, and this depends on a lot of things working out, is that if Julian is forced to take certain kinds of positions at the national level, which are more liberal or which are out of step with Texas, those are going to be connected to what Joaquin does in Texas. So he will be cursed with the sins of his brother. And that could be good or bad, depending on how things go.
Well, a big key component to what will make Castro successful is ability to get voters registered, new voters registered, and out to the polls.
Yep.
We've still got this ongoing issue with voter registration. In Texas, the Secretary of State was at it again, and they did it again after saying they didn't and tried to remove a bunch of names, except this time the director of the DPS took the blame, conveniently so.
Yeah, Director McCraw basically fell on his sword, saying that it was effectively DPS's fault that a lot of these mistakes were made. Obviously, there's a lot of responsibility here to go around. There are a lot of blame to be shed. But the fact that this is still an issue, I think, shows that the Democrats aren't going to let this go. And I think they probably shouldn't. I mean, they've got here a clear-cut case where Republicans were caught playing politics with this. And if it's going to be something Democrats really focus on and energize voters over and maybe have some legal changes through, then they have to make this issue work for them.
Well, we know that in the legislature right now, there's a lot going on, Brandon. The House just passed the first stage of the budget process, a big budget.
Big budget, yeah.
Big budget with lots going on. The Senate just passed a major package, Senate Bill 6, 7, and 8, cleared unanimously that dealt with Harvey-related aid using the rainy day fund, what people have been calling for, lots of bipartisan support. A lot of bipartisanship this cycle. What do you think?
I think it's interesting. I mean, to me, this is a pretty fiscally conservative budget. They're paying their debts, right? They have to do some IOUs from last session. They're also taking care of some Harvey issues. That's something I think which is clearly needed. I didn't think they would do this, but they're literally spending almost all of the money that they're allowed to spend, and they're dipping into the rainy day fund by about $2 billion. So this is a pretty significant change. Keep in mind that the governor has to sign a supplemental bill, which they have passed, to be able to keep certain healthcare providers being paid. That's part of the IOU process. But there's still differences between what the House and the Senate want to do. So this difference could create some friction down the road. But I see overall this as being a move in the direction and probably largely reflecting of two things. Number one, Hurricane Harvey and its devastation. And number two, the fact that people are really worried and unhappy with the underinvestment in virtually everything in Texas. No longer can Texas be called a sort of low tax, low service state. People want that change. I think the election showed that, and this budget probably reflects that.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. Elections matter, yeah. And the last go around, the midterms, I think shifted the politics in the legislature to, as you said, it's a move in the right direction as far as investing back in Texas. Well, Brandon, we had a court case that came about, a settlement that allows Native American inmates in prison to actually wear long hair, which we know is something that's barred. So while we may have taken away their land, we're letting them have long hair in prison.
This is a really fascinating case, yeah. I mean, this district court judge ruled in favor of inmates who say that restricting these inmates from wearing their hair long as part of their religion was a violation. So I find it really interesting to see this dimension of kind of, you know, religion versus sort of crime and punishment issues. It doesn't affect a lot of people. There are only 5,000 plus Native American prisoners all over the country. But this is, I think, a really interesting way to be able to understand how things are changing, I think, in terms of prison politics. So we'll see how this plays out. But I think definitely the case that we see some movement on sort of allowing for prisons to be more humane.
Well, you know, on this show, we have been talking about the scourge of state takeovers of local control for the last few years. I talked about how Governor Abbott wants to be the mayor of Texas, right, Not the governor of Texas. Well, here's an issue that looks like it may be preempting some local laws that we can get behind, Brandon. I don't know about you, but when you take your dog and you're trying to go to a restaurant, it's a beautiful day like it is. You want to sit out on the patio, just, you know, maybe have a beer. A lot of places around the state of Texas banned that, but now the Texas government is stepping in to try to clear that up.
That's right. Senator Kelly Hancock, who is a conservative Republican, has authored this bill, which has passed, at least in the Senate, that allows for that to occur and also bans local governments from not letting that happen. So it's a pretty interesting phenomenon here. As you say, the state's basically running local government now. I don't even know why local governments bother, but to me, the problem is that this, I think, is going to end up like Go Dog Go, where like literally every place you look, there's a dog in trees, like driving cars. And so I'm not 100% for it, but I will take my dog for a beer. That's true.
Yeah, that's right. Every patio in Texas has now become a dog park, right?
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, I guess I suppose what's going to happen is if you don't like dogs and or you've got some allergic issues, yeah, that's, I think, going to be the interesting sort of counter to it.
And my dog is awful. Like, she would not be good in a patio situation. So, like, she would be tipping over stuff and, you know, drinking beer. I'm not going to take her. But I like the idea.
Yeah, on principle, I'm fine with it. I think the issue ends up to me is, again, we talked about this, I like local control. Yeah. Local ordinance wants to do it, fine. If not, you certainly should be able to ban it if you want to. Yeah. Well, Brandon, let's talk the big news on the 2020, how it affects Texas and the U.S. presidential race. Beto O'Rourke is in.
Hey, Beto late than never,
Yes, Beto for Prezo, right?
Beto for Prezo, yeah.
Beto for Prezo. So let's kind of break this down, right? We talked a lot about this in the past, especially when he's in the running for Senate. We talked a little bit about sort of the new reality of the way the primary process is on the Democratic side and even nationally in terms of raising money. Let's handicap the Beto O'Rourke race. What do you think?
You know, I am not sure where Beto stands politically. Honestly, Jay, you and I follow this more than virtually anybody in this country. I don't know how to label him. Now, he says he's not about labels, but he's taken conservative positions. He's taken liberal positions. He's changed his mind on entitlements. He's changed his mind on single payer. I don't know where to put him. He says labels don't matter, but you know who thinks labels matter? Democrats, right? And they're going to be picking apart everything he does. So I think that reveal of these political issues is a problem for him, in addition to the kind of personal stuff we've seen, which is also problematic, right? He was a part of an activist hacking group known as Psychedelic Warlord, right? He has bizarre hand gestures, which were made fun of by Jimmy Fallon. There's a lot of problems that came about. Now, Democrats can probably look past this because they want to fall in love, as you say, right, as opposed to falling in line. But I'm worried that this rollout was pretty bad.
Well, I mean, here's the counter to that. The rollout was not ideal in the sense that, as you said, a lot of the negative historical stuff, some of which we already saw here, yeah, in Texas. We know the GOP put out this lovely St. Patrick's Day message of the Beto O'Rourke DUI from when he was in college.
They put the little cartoon
hat on him. A little cartoon Irish leprechaun hat on top. offending many both Catholics and Irish people across the country.
Our former producer, right?
That's right. Right. Edel was was like, "What's going on here?" So interesting sort of dynamic there. Everything you said is true. Lots of issues, lots of negative stuff came out. Still managed to get massive crowds everywhere he went. Managed to break all records, 6.1 million in the first 24 hours.
And tremendous number of donors, too.
Yes, over 128,000 donors from every state. The only person with more donors is Bernie Sanders. And he raised more than Sanders over the 6.1, an average contribution amount of $47. The Beto magic, at least on the money side, is still there. He's still ginning up. And here's my issue. The problem for other candidates is the narrative of the campaign is entirely dominated by Beto. It's all about his politics. Is he a liberal? Is he a moderate or a centrist? What is he? That's all the questions anyone's talking about. Meanwhile, you have all these other candidates out there struggling to get a moment of airtime. If you look at the social media input, it's been massively in favor of O'Rourke, both in terms of Google searches, Twitter, all the various sort of outlets that people access information. So he's dominating social media, mainstream media. We'll see how long it lasts. Yeah. My general idea is that the most progressive elements of the party are really spoken for. And O'Rourke's not going to get them. What he's really trying to do is thread this needle between sort of centrist and progressive, right? Kind of the Obama lane.
It's
interesting that a lot of the Obama people are with him, David Plouffe, John Favreau, those guys are all back in O'Rourke.
He got a lot of the support from the Obama bros, not so much from the women, and I think that could be a problem for him, right? I mean, there's a kind of undercurrent of dissatisfaction, but I totally agree that there are some positives for him, especially being in the kind of moderate lane. So looking at some numbers from CNN, he's plus 33 for moderate favorability, where that's a lot lower for somebody like Klobuchar, who's probably much more moderate than him. She's about plus 10. He's plus 65 favorability for white college grads. She is only about plus 30. He's got a tremendous amount of enthusiasm. That gap is big for him. And so in terms of favorability, so he's very much in a position where he can use that enthusiasm to his liking. So I think that's good. On the negative side, though, there are still a significant number of Democrats who've never heard of him. And clearly it's early, but the field is really broad. And he's a three-term congressman without a whole lot of accomplishments. So it's going to have to be inspirational. And that will only go so far as the news media will give him that.
I mean, the interesting thing to me is he's got the ability. We saw this in Texas where he's a tremendous retail campaigner.
Yes.
He likes to travel.
Standing up on tables and stuff,
sure.
Right?
He is, as Trump might say, a high-energy candidate.
Right.
He can draw crowds like essentially Sanders. He and are really the two that have been can draw really massive crowds.
Yeah.
And he gives, he can inspire people even with his sort of awkwardness as a speaker. No one should mistake him for Barack Obama when it comes to eloquence, because he's certainly not that.
He's much less scripted, though, which people like.
Right. Yes, he is very natural as a speaker, and I think there's something to that. Look, the biggest issue is, can he continue to raise money? You've got a very compressed timetable. You only need a certain percentage of the vote to stay with you to go on because of the Democratic Party system now where it's proportional. If I was going to handicap, I think O'Rourke's in it for the long haul. The big challenge for, I think, candidates would be like Julian Castro, Kirsten Gillibrand. Those second-tier candidates are struggling to break through.
They're really gone. Questions for me, number one, how will he fare in debates? Number two, how does he distinguish himself? And number three, what will Donald Trump's nickname for him be? Still to be seen.
Crazy hands.
There you go.
I'm going with crazy hands. Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our producer, Sophie Mall. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd Big Audio Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.